Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Unfortunately, Larry Collins has passed away. Him and his sister Lori, who passed away in 2019, were the Collins kids. When they were, I think, 10 and 12 in the 1950s, they started to appear on this California television show called Town Hall Party. And there's lots of clips on it on YouTube. We refer to some of them in the interview, and I recommend watching them. They're really incredible time capsule into what was happening, just television production and music and country music in California and America, the world. They're just a great window into the past. So an interesting interview. This is a live interview with the two of them, and just listening back to it makes me wish I had another opportunity to chat with them, because there's just so much more we could have talked about with the two of them and their long careers and comebacks, etc. And Larry co-wrote the song Delta Dawn that was number one for Helen Reddy in 73, was a country hit for Tanya Tucker. Bette Midler, though, was the first person to record it. I didn't know that. And then after the Collins kids, we're going to hear from William Bell. He's still around, Memphis songwriter, Stax performing artist. The only reason we're hearing this was because I spoke to him on the same show as the Collins kids, so why not? Let's air this one too. Pay tribute to the great William Bell. So we're starting off, though, first with me and Larry and Lori Collins. These are from 2009, and, you know, we pay tribute to the great late Larry Collins.
Yeah, there are the Collins kids. Are you guys with me on the phone, Larry and Lori Collins?
Yes, we are, Michael.
It's
good to be rockabilling up in New York City.
Larry, did you ever get your hot rod?
You know, yeah, for a time when I was in my teens, I had a pretty cool Pontiac that I hot rodded up a little bit. And but I love them. At my age, I want another one soon.
You guys born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, let's just say in the early 40s, right?
Yeah. 44 for me, yeah.
And grew up...
And I don't know if Lori will tell you hers or not.
Lori's a lady. She does not have to tell us.
I don't have to.
us old rockabilly, hairy-legged boys do, right?
Nothing to be ashamed of. Were you guys born on a farm? Were your folks farmers?
Dairy farmers.
They were dairy farmers.
And did you spend your days doing chores before you became international rock stars?
Yeah. Lori, you want to take that one?
Well, we did. You know, of course, everybody had to help out. Dairy farming is a very, very demanding job. You know, the cows don't take a day off. So, we all pitched in. Our older sister also, Sherry, she was given the job of looking after us as well. Hmm. So she had it the hardest.
So the story is, I believe, that Lori showed singing talent at an incredibly young age and went to sing at a talent show nearby and was discovered by Leon McAuliffe. Is that correct?
That's true.
Right. Yeah. She, the whole family got, well, Lori, you know, we used to sing in church as little bitty kids at about the grand old age of, what were you then? Almost seven, Lori, probably something like that. Seven, I would think. And there was a show in Tulsa called at the Cimarron Ballroom called Leon McAuliffe and the West. I think it was the Western Playboys, and he was the big time guy. And they took her down there, and she just, you know, Lori at that age could belt out a song. So he said, "You have two choices to really, if you're interested in really pursuing this. You got Nashville or Hollywood." And we had an aunt who lived out in L.A., so we went west.
That's amazing. Lori, you just at a very young age could just go and belt out a song, and there was never any fear or self-consciousness?
No, not really, and I think it was because of being around music, you know, our whole life. My mother's side of the family was very musical, and they were all very supportive, and, you know, I can't say I wasn't nervous, you know, especially going to see Leon McAuliffe, you know, and singing for him.
Did they just marched you into the backstage and said, sing for this man, and you just stood there and a cappella belted out a song? Is that right?
Well, that's true. Yeah. Wheel of Fortune.
That's the song that started it all. Yeah, I've heard the story that you guys used to play music separately in separate rooms until your parents said, enough of this, two different songs, you know, they could sit in the kitchen and hear it. They said, get in one room and sing together. Is that true?
Yeah,
it is true.
I got a guitar for Christmas, and, you know, with me, it was just a natural thing. You know, Mom showed me a couple of chords, and by the end of the day, I was singing, and you know, I'm the original child for Ritalin. You know, I was doing backflips and playing my little $12 Stella guitar.
Mm.
And we went out to our grandma's. We'd always go to our grandma, Grandpa Collins' farm for Christmas, the whole family. And so that's where I made my debut, and of course, I did my whole deal.
Hmm.
And everybody thought I was absolutely nutsoid.
Well,
because I boogie woogie woogie. You know?
Yeah, I guess this is the very early 50s, and rock and roll was not on every TV channel and in commercials and things. It was still this kind of alien, no one was sure it was still going to be around.
Well, now that the word rock and roll hadn't been even coined then, even the word rockabilly.
So you guys went out to live with your aunt in Los Angeles. Was that culture shock coming from Oklahoma?
Oh,
yeah,
boy, was it ever, I think, for all of us, you know. But especially, I think it was for my dad, you know, because my dad wasn't really excited about moving, selling his cows and taking the money and moving to California. It was not really what he wanted to do, but
nor was I.
Yeah, my mom and I were kind of relentless, and so he finally agreed to do it. But yeah, it was a huge, huge move for them.
It seems like you pretty quickly got right. You got working right away. How did that happen? Was it luck, or did you know some people, or just the right place, the right time?
We didn't know anyone except our aunt. We just went to a lot of different talent shows on weekends, and, you know, and that's kind of how it got started. And we went to one at a place called the Riverside Rancho, which is in the San Fernando Valley in California. And it was funny because we at that particular time we would enter separately, and Larry won and I came in second.
Interesting, you know, from my debut at the Collins, my grandma and grandpa's house, I wouldn't play for anybody for a while, you know, so I was hiding with my Stella guitar and doing my own deal. And then one day when they wanted to go do this show, and it was actually the Chef Molani show, Lori, on the back of a flatbed pickup. And I went to my mom and dad and said, look, I want to enter this amateur show. And they said, well, what do you do? And I said, I've been practicing. And so they looked at each other and said, okay. So they went, and we went, and that's where I got very fortunate, and beat my sister.
Well, together.
And so after that, Dad said, "Why don't you guys work together?" And then we went to the Squeaky Deacons. He recommended Town Hall Party, and we went down there and auditioned on a Friday night, and they hired us. And the next night, Saturday night, we started the television show that we did for how many years, Lori?
What?
Lori, how many years were you guys? I think it was 56 to 59 you were on Town Hall Party. There's a DVD, a couple DVDs of that stuff, and it's very easy to find on YouTube. And it is amazing how much poise you guys had and professionalism, considering how quickly you were on TV. Did it just come natural, or were you sort of schooled or warned to act a certain way on there?
No.
Well, it was just natural. We were ever schooled.
You know, and all the people in Town Hall Party were just, I mean, absolute pros, and working with people like that, you know, it was all live, live television, live radio. And you went out there, you had one shot at it, and you did it.
Yeah,
and,
for folks who've never seen it, it's pretty amazing. Tex Ritter comes out, and he sort of very gently introduces all these people who come up and do a song, and sometimes it's a very simple setting, or you know, and the playing is amazing, and the level of professionalism is amazing, and also the variety of country music showcased within those little programs is amazing. And then, the Collins Kids comes on, and Larry especially looks like, yeah, you drank a pot of coffee before you went.
You know, even to this day, I go out there, when Lori and I go out there, I mean, something happens, and I can't be still. I still boogie and do my little dance across the stage and pick that double-neck guitar, and Lori and I just have fun. I mean, you know, it's a natural, it's always been a natural place for us to be. It's a gift. Yeah, you know, it's just a gift.
That's great. Did folks take you under their wing? I mean, obviously Joe Mafis took you, Larry, under the wing, but as a community, were everyone like, this is tomorrow's stars, let's help them out a little bit?
Go ahead, Lori.
I didn't really understand the question. I'm sorry.
Sure, it's okay. Were you guys taken under some of the older, more experienced stars' wings and tutored and taught and told the ways of show business?
No, not really. I mean, they all took us under their wing just as, you know, kids, because, you know, but as far as sitting down and telling us what to do, no one ever did. You know, I think they appreciated what we did at such an early age, and you know, being around them, I think, matured us more, and we watched, you know, we didn't know anything, and I think we just, you know, watched what they were doing as far as professionalism and just went out and did it, you know. But Tex Ritter really became someone that took us under his wing, and they all kind of protected us, you know,
yeah,
and looked after us. And it was a wonderful, wonderful time in the 50s to be in the music business.
You guys got signed to Columbia.
Interesting thing about that is that they treated us as their peers, and we weren't treated as children, you know, and coddled at all. You know, we had a job to do, and we did it.
Larry, at 12 years old, did you feel any pressure?
No, not at all. Well, you know, when Joe Mafis would come up to you, or Merle Travis, I was fortunate to grow up with probably the finest, two of the finest guitar players that ever lived, Merle Travis and Joe Mafis, who was known as the King of the Strings. And Merle Travis is known for, like, one of the original finger-picking guys who, was actually Chet Atkins' hero, and that's how Chet learned the finger-picking style. Of course, it came from the old blues. But playing with those guys, it was, you know, there was no big rehearsal. I mean, we'd go backstage and say, Larry, we're going to do a boogie and E. I'll take the first one. I'll play a boogie and you take it and I'll take it. And we just nodded each other. And then we'd go out there. And, of course, Joe Mathis, you know, everything he did was on fire.
Yeah.
And at my age, I could keep up with it. But as far as learning, just watching those guys and you know, just when it pointed to me, I went.
That was
turn him loose, let him go.
There's a great clip of you and Joe Mafis and Merle Travis playing Wildwood Flower. It's just kind of a state, and all three of you take a turn and you play each other's guitars, and it just looks like a riot, you know.
Yeah, that's probably one of my favorite videos. All three of us end up playing my guitar.
Right,
three guys playing, and it's like, whoa! I mean, how cool would that be for a kid that age?
And to watch for the folks at home. You got signed to Columbia Records in 1955. Now, Columbia was not, you know, the rock and roll, home of rock and roll. Mitch Miller and a very old American record company. Did they understand what rock and roll was? How were you treated there? And tell me about the recording process.
Well, it, you know, as far as what we did, you know, they loved that. And stood behind us, and in the beginning, we were kind of able to, you know, pretty much choose the material, and a lot of it were songs that we had written, you know, like Whistle Bait and Mercy and Hot Rod, you know, which I thought was, you know, that was our signature kind of music, and so in the beginning, it was great, and then we had Mitch Miller kind of step in to the picture, and a lot of things changed. He was not a rock and roll fan, and he thought it was evil, and can you believe that? I mean,
he was right.
Those little demon-possessed Collins kid.
Yeah. But so he started choosing a lot of our material, and it became more middle of the road. And I think, you know, it was something Larry and I didn't really want to do, but, you know, we were young and kids and new at this, so you just kind of put yourself in their hands.
Yeah. Well, the early records certainly have an amazing energy on them. How did that happen? Was it just what you guys, and like you said, a lot of the songs you guys wrote, did you just come in there and run down a song and the band would work it up and that was just what it sounded like?
Yeah, usually it was in one or two takes. I mean, we knew our material because we wrote it, you know.
Yeah.
So it was pretty easy, and of course we had great musicians too. Joe,
you know, most of the guys from Town Hall Party
played
on it.
Yeah,
all the early stuff. Yeah.
So those guys from Town Hall Party would just come down and lay down a couple songs real quick. So it was a real natural.
All of it was cut at a studio called, I think it was Radio Recorders down in Hollywood. And we'd just go on, and I never will forget my first session. I wasn't tall enough for the mic for some reason. So they got a riser out for me. And I had my double guitar, I stepped on this riser, and I think, I don't remember exactly what we were recording, but it was our first recording session. And those big RCA microphones. I kept saying, getting close, and I got real close to the mic, and let me tell you, a lightning bolt. I got shocked.
Oh.
I got knocked off the riser, and I fell it. Damn, there, killed me. But that was like maybe our first experience recording.
Huh.
But interesting, you know, through Don Law was our producer who signed us to Columbia, and, you know, doing Town Hall Party, like, every entertainer from Johnny Cash to Bob Wills to all the great Lefty Frizzell, I could go on, Patsy Cline, all these people, when they came to L.A., would do Town Hall Party or shows. So we got to know all these great, great characters and great performers. And Don Law actually signed Johnny Cash from Sun at our dining room table, because they'd all come to our house, and that's when he left Sun and went with Columbia Records. And we toured with Johnny a lot. That was a lot of our younger years. I mean, a jillion tours all the way up through Canada and the U.S., you know. And Johnny was a hell of a guy and treated us with great respect and never missed a show. Contrary to popular belief, he was in this screwed up, as a lot of people think he was.
Speaking of screwed up, I mean, did you ever stop for a minute and go, boy, I wish I could just go to high school and, you know, do the regular boring thing? Or were you always cool having that different life?
I did want to play baseball when I was about 9 or something like that. So I made the team at the school, and they found out about it. And Tex Ritter came and had a talk with me and said, boy, do you realize how many people are depending on you? And he laid it out pretty straight to me that I can't mess up my fingers.
That's pretty heavy. That's a pretty heavy thing for a 9-year-old kid, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, look what I got to do.
Yeah,
look who I got
sure.
to play guitar with.
One of the things, too, Michael, that our dad did is, if we stocked up on rehearsing, we used to rehearse every day at least, two or three hours.
Mm.
But he, when we would kind of slack, he would take the tube out of the TV so we couldn't watch the TV.
It's a good trick. In the late 50s, Lori, you were the girlfriend on and off screen of Ricky Nelson and Larry, and you both appeared on The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet on that TV show. Ricky was just giant at that time. I mean, that must have been, there wasn't the paparazzi there was today, but as if, you needed even more media attention, what kind of a guy, just briefly, what kind of a guy was Ricky? I mean, he seems like the nicest guy in the world.
Well, he was, and he was very shy, I guess is the word, and I think in the music business, he was kind of unsure of himself, being around like Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins and some of the people that used to come over to our house, I think he was quite taken back with them, because he was just starting his journey, But we had a great relationship, and I think initially it started just with both of us kind of being, teenagers and having huge responsibilities as far as our shows, our respected shows. And so it was kind of fun to get together. And it's funny, though, when we did get together, we played music a lot. And, of course, Larry was always with us, and when we would go out on dates, I wasn't allowed to go to the drive-in unless Larry got to go. we sent him to the snack bar a lot.
I'll bet you did. But then you're 17 years old, and Lori, you married Stu Carnell, who was Johnny Cash's manager and quite a few years older than you. Had you guys been courting on the sly?
Yeah, I guess that you could say that. I always just say to myself, I must have lost my mind. It was a really, really awful part of my life. As far as the way I did it, I ended up with two beautiful daughters and was married to him for 20 years.
So
it's just what it was, and I wish sometimes I could redo it, but you can't.
It upset a bunch of people, and it sort of caused a rift between your family and yourself. Is that right?
Yes, a big one.
Yeah, a big one. Well, that's too bad. Ed, Larry, you sort of went solo at that point, made some great rock and roll records, but eventually you guys did get back together and do some appearances, some TV stuff. You also sort of got into the Vegas, Reno, that whole scene. What was your show like at that point? That would be sort of the mid-60s, right?
Yeah, and also, we're doing like television shows like Shindig. I don't recall Shindig and that sort of stuff. It was still jumping. We didn't do too much of our old stuff at that time because of the period. That's when we were doing mainly hit songs of that time. And it was a little flower childish. Leather pants with fringe and not psychedelic, but no matter what Lori and I do, any kind of song we take and do, it's going to sound rockabilly because, that's our soul. That's what we do. Everything's real high energy and get out there and flat get it.
Let's talk about some of those very early songs. Some of them you wrote together. A lot of them Larry wrote. Were they written backstage or in your room? Or, hey, Lori, I've got an idea for a song. And how long would it take to put together a whole song?
You know, back then you'd get a title. And I still write that way to this day. It usually starts with the title. And like Hot Rod, you know. So we'd come up with a title. And basically I'd a riff. A rockabilly riff that sounded right for it, and from that, you know, it seems to kind of roll out. You know, it's not a painstaking process. It happens. Music and a title, then a riff, and the words come as you go.
Larry, you went on to write and produce lots of country music hits, including Delta Dawn, that was a hit a couple times for a couple different people. And when did someone come knocking on your guys' door and say, we want the Collins Kids back? When did that happen?
From the Reno Tahoe Vegas deal, at one point, Lori and I... said when we weren't having fun with it anymore, we'd stop. It wasn't like a big explosion to stop at that period in our life, similar to the Everly brothers, who are very good friends of ours, both of them. We just weren't having fun with it, and I was going to go write and be a studio musician for a while. But they kept asking us to go to Europe, you know, there was a year go by that they'd call and say, you've got to come to this show called Hensby in Europe. And Lori wanted to go, and I just kept saying, no. And then finally, after 4 or 5 years of that, I was playing golf at a country club in Reno called Hidden Valley. And I saw this guy standing over by a tree. He looked like a hell Bigfoot. And he was holding something in his arms, you know, and I'm putting out on the 18th green. and this guy starts walking towards me, and I thought, what the heck's going on here? And it was Simmy Mosley, the guy who made my first Mosrite guitar. Joe and I were fortunate to have the first Mosrite double-neck guitars ever made. And he walked up on the green, and I said, Simmy. And I started crying, of course. And he had this beautiful guitar, which I play now on stage. And he put it in my arms and said, go back to work. And so we did.
And
so
what we went through, what year was that?
Lori, when was that? 80?
You know, I think it was 1995 or 96.
And so did all the bad feelings just go away? Did it just seem like time to do this?
Yeah, I think so.
The honor of all the Europeans, you know, our records doing so well over there. And when we went, especially to have kids from 14 to 60 in the audience all singing Hot Rod, Skip and Jump, and our rockabilly songs and Mercy, and knew all the lyrics and knew more about our lives than we did and how we recorded them. I tell you what, it was very humbling.
So
we've been, right, Lori?
Oh, well, it was magical, you know, to stand up there and sing and have them know every single word to your song. And, you know, it was like, something that we had never ever experienced before, and it was wonderful. You know, it just was a wonderful thing to have know that they've, you know, they're keeping our music alive. And I think we all fell in love with each other, us and the audience. You know.
Yeah, it is. It's an amazing thing. You guys have a gig coming up right here in town, Friday, July 17th, part of the Ponderosa Stomp at Lincoln Center. You're playing this amazing gig with Carl Mann and Joe Clay, and it's all backed by Deke Dickerson and the Ecophonics. I just saw Deke playing with Carl Mann and Joe Clay at the Ponderosa Stomp in New Orleans, and I really need to take a minute out to say there could be no better backing band for you guys. These guys seem to get it exactly right.
Well, it's the real deal.
We have an interesting story about Dee Dickerson.
Well, let's hear it.
When we decided to go to England to do the MC Festival, we needed a band to work with us. And so they suggested Deke Dickerson and Dee. They were then known as Dave and Deke.
Right.
And so anyway, they drove up to Reno to rehearse with us. And it was so funny. And when they came to the door, you know, they all had on their 50s garb, their white T-shirts and their jeans rolled up, you know. So anyway, when we started rehearsing, it was amazing. They knew every single song that we have ever done. And if we didn't sing it exactly like the record, they would interrupt us and say, well, no, you used to do it that way.
They corrected you guys.
Yeah.
If I hit one lick that was a little hotter than it should have been, you know, like it not the simplicity of rockabilly, they'd say, you didn't play that. It's got to be right, man.
Wow.
So the direction of keeping our music really raw. You know, Lori and I, let's face it, we're just raw. Raw rockabilly, and that's what when the folks come to Lincoln Center, that's what they're going to see. They're going to see that we're a little older, maybe a lot older, but we still do the raw
Speak
rockabilly.
For yourself.
Same tempo, and you know, we're coming to boogie.
And you've both definitely still got the energy of teenagers, which is an amazing thing. The gig is Friday, July 17th. It's outdoors at Damrosch Park, part of the Ponderosa Stomp at Lincoln Center. And folks can get tickets and information at ponderosastomp.com/Lincoln. It's you guys, the Collins Kids, Carl Mann, and Joe Clay, all backed by Deke Dickerson and the Echophonics. I think this is something even folks who think they don't like rockabilly would enjoy. It's just going to be a fun show.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They got a little rhythm in their bones.
Dancing, you know, from the 50s was just incredible and an awful lot of fun. And so we haven't worked in New York for quite a while, and they've asked us, and it just never worked out. But so we're very, very excited to come to New York.
Mm. Also, there'll be a DJ Todophonic. Todd will be there. Have you guys ever heard of him?
Yeah, we know Todd. We met him in New Orleans, and he's a great cat.
He's off the wall. You've got to watch out for him. Just keep your distance from Todd. The whole thing also is going to be recorded and played on the 30th right here on WFMU.
That's what we heard. That's really exciting.
Yeah, that is exciting. So the crowd can, you know, make some noise and hear himself on the radio later. How long are you guys going to keep doing this for eternity?
Till we drop.
I guess as long as we can hobble up on the stage. I don't know. We really don't talk about that. You know, it's basically we just take each show we do. And, you know, we don't do a lot of shows. We probably do, maybe 5 or 6 shows a year.
Yeah, something like that.
And where do you guys live?
I live in Reno, Nevada.
Oh.
Yeah, and I'm down in Santa Barbara, California.
Well, so it sounds like a great life. Larry and Lori Collins, thanks so much for joining us. This has been amazing. I've got the song Let's Have a Party queued up here to get us out of here. Is there anything we need to know about this song or about how did you first hear this song?
You know, I'm not sure how we first heard it, but I think we were the first to record it. Wanda Jackson, we were honored when she came out. We just did a show in Oklahoma with her not too long ago, and she's a good friend. She came up and said she'd learned it from our record. And then Presley, I think, came out later with it. But I'm not sure how that song came to us. But
it's a great song.
Yeah, it's
a great song. So, and look, we'd like to say also to the New York folks, come get down and do some rockabilly boogie with us.
All right, we will see you Friday, July 17th, and I'll give that information again at the end of the show for anybody who missed it. Larry and Lori Collins, thank you guys so much. It's really a very, very interesting story, and the music will always just be fantastic.
Thank you, Michael.
Michael.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Happy 4th of July, guys. Some people like to rock. Some people like to roll. But moving and a groove is going to satisfy the soul. Let's have a party. Woo! Let's have a party. Send me to the store. Let's buy some more. Let's have a party tonight. I've never kissed a bear. I've never kissed a goon. But I can shake a chicken in the middle of the room. Let's have a party. Woo! Yeah, there's Mr. William Bell, and you don't miss your water. William Bell, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing great.
That song sounds great. You hold the distinction of being one of the longest-running artists on Stax. You were there just about at the beginning and just about at the end and got to see the whole thing go down.
Yes, I've been, blessed to still be around, and I've seen it all.
Yeah. You have 13 songs on the Billboard charts. Born, I believe, right in Memphis, Tennessee, right?
Yes.
So you couldn't be any more Memphis-y. As Stax really is the definition of that Memphis soul sound. You were born, I think, 1939, is that right?
That is correct.
And growing up, what kind of music was in your house? How did you get to where you, to your sound?
Well, it was just like a melting pot. We heard country and western, which is, they were calling it rockabilly back then, of course. And we heard blues, of course, and jazz, and of course, gospel.
And were your folks, was there music in the house? Did they play instruments?
Not my mom or dad. They didn't play any instruments, but my mom did sing in church, yes.
So I guess you were just a young teenager during the Second World War and that time. What was Memphis like back then? It's hard to imagine.
Oh, yes. I grew up during the heyday, I guess you say, of all of the guys coming up like B.B. and Bobby Bland and Junior Parker and all those guys. So I was a teenager and sneaking down on Beale Street and hanging out, and finally I got a job in a club called the Flamingo Room down there.
Did you sing in the church choir?
Yes, I did. I every Sunday and Wednesday rehearsals. Yeah, I was singing in the church choir at a very early age.
And was there any inkling that you might want to do music for a profession, or was that not even in your mind as a little kid, as a teenager?
Well, back then, I didn't think of doing it as a profession because I had plans on becoming a doctor. My mom wanted me to become the first doctor in the family and all of that. So, after about 14 years old, the actual music bug bit me, and I was hooked after that.
No looking back. You're in a band called the Del Rios. I think that's your first band that sort of made a mark. Is that right?
That's right. We won a talent contest, and then we got a job at the Flamingo Room.
And so that would be like you know, mid-1950s, 56, 57, somewhere around there. What was the Memphis scene like? I mean, I've always read that there were just lots and lots of clubs, and every band was better than the next one.
Yes, we had clubs all over the place, and of course, down on Beale, that was during part of the heyday of Beale Street. And our club was right off of Beale on Hernando. But right up the street there, you had Club Handy, where B.B. and Bobby and all of those guys played. So the experience of just growing up around so much talent and so much music, it was just tremendous.
Yeah, what did it mean to have a gig at the Flamingo? Was that a 5 nights or 6 nights a week, or was it 6 hours a night? What kind of a commitment was that?
Well, I was still in high school, so I could only work on the weekends.
Hmm.
And my mom agreed that as long as Phineas Newborn had me back home to go to church on Sunday morning, I could work Friday nights, after school. I'd work Friday night and Saturday.
And how long were those sets?
We did a 15-minute set. The band would play 30 minutes, and then I would come on and sing like 4 or 15 minutes, and then we'd have to go to the back. We couldn't sit out front because we were too young to be out front, but we'd go in the back and sit in the dressing room.
Hmm. And what was there just pocket money? How much money could a high school kid make doing that?
Well, to us it was big money, but the experience of it was like going to university. The experience of just being around musicians like the David Fathead Newman and Charles Lloyd and Gene Bowlegs Miller and all those people and all of the Phineas Newborn Jr.
Yeah, Willie Mitchell, Ben Branch, all these guys had bands out there.
Yeah. And just that experience to a young kid, that was priceless. So we didn't make a lot of money, and sometimes we didn't make any, but just the experience of learning our craft and knowing how to entertain and be surrounded by older musicians that were supportive of what we were trying to do.
Hmm. So it's sort of great timing for you because Stax started, I think, around 1961. How did they find you? How did you get there?
Well, through Chips Moman, who was a musician and producer, and one of the first engineers at Stax.
Yeah, people forget that Chips, who later made hits with Elvis and all kinds of people, was early a big part of Stax.
Right, absolutely. And most of the guys in my group, the Del Rios, were older than I, so they were a couple of them were drafted, and I went to do a solo thing, and Chips was always asking me why I didn't cut a record, and so finally I agreed to do 4 sides.
And did Chips just know you from seeing you live?
Yes, he knew me from seeing me live at the Flamingo.
Hmm. So, and he just brought you in, and it was that easy, and then you kind of stayed.
Well, he asked me about a year prior. And then I went on tour during the summertime with Phineas Newborn's orchestra, and I was in New York for a while and working out in Long Island. And that's when I wrote You Don't Miss Your Water, so I got homesick. And when I came back, Chips approached me again about it, and so, of course, I had 4 songs written, and I did the 4 songs.
Hmm. So let's talk about that process for a minute. When you would come in with a song, would you just play it on the piano and sing it to them, or would you have made a demo already?
No. We would just play it live. We would audition live and play it on a piano or a guitar and sing it. And, of course, Chips fell in love with You Don't Miss Your Water, and we went in and did a demo of it. And, of course, it was kind of a funny thing because Jim Stewart thought it was too gospel at first, and he didn't like it, but Mrs. Axton loved it, so finally it came out as a single.
That's interesting. It went to 95 on the Billboard chart, and it's become, you know, it must be, is it the most covered of the songs that you've written?
Not really, but it's responsible, and it's known as being the first real Southern soul type ballad.
Yeah.
And I guess either born under a bad sign or I Forgot to Be Your Lover has been the most recorded and covered song by different acts and artists.
Interesting. So how long was the process from when you sort of play a song for Chip's Moment till the record is finished? How long, what happened in between those two things?
Well, I think he was just kind of happy that I finally agreed to do four songs. And it didn't take that long. I think it took us a couple of months to just get everything recorded and finished, because back then, you know, we recorded the band and the singer all at the same time.
Mm.
So it took us roughly about a month to really get it ready to release it. But it took another 3 or 4 months before it came out. We got it ready in the latter part of, I think, 61, and then it didn't really become popular until January or February of 62.
But the actual recording and working up the arrangement, that's all real quite fast?
Yeah, that went quite fast, because we had more or less, it was just gospel type of piano with Marvell Thomas Rufus' son playing piano on it. So it was just a four-piece thing, and then we put the horns and organ on it later.
So Stax in the early 60s was slowly sort of churning up, and you get drafted, I think, 1963, is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
And where do they send you? Where did you go? What did you do?
Well, at first I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana for basic training and then advanced training. So I stayed down there two stints, and then I was shipped to Hawaii, and I spent quite a bit of time in Hawaii. And then
that's not bad.
And then we never went into actual battle, but I was deployed to over in Nam for a little while for the unit that I was in.
Wow! So you got back just in the nick of time, it sounds like.
Yes, I was pretty short on what they call a short timer, so I was pretty short with my time. So I was over only for like a couple of months, and then back to Hawaii because I was getting out of the military in about 3 months.
Hmm. You come back, and you write Born Under a Bad Sign, you talked about. That really became signature song for Albert King, and it was covered by Cream and all kinds of people. It's become a blues standard. That's, I think, around 1967. I want to ask you, how much hanging around was there at Stax?
Quite a bit on my part, because I was always interested in the behind-the-scenes aspect as well as performing, but I wanted to know why, you know, how did you record, how you mic a drum, or all of those technical things. I was always interested in that, and so I hung around Stax, and like I said, got a lot of just great on-the-job training there.
Well, that's a song, Born Under a Bad Sign, you wrote with Booker T. Jones. A lot of your stuff is collaborations with him. Was that let's go over to somebody's house and write a song, or was it just, hey, I've got an idea, or was it just casual, or did you sit down to write songs?
Well, it was just like a pairing of good lyricists and everything with a musician, and because Jim always, and rightly so, he wanted to have good lyrical content and also good melodic structure. So he would pair off a lyricist with just a tried-and-true musician. So Booker and I knew each other, and he was a church organist at the church that I attended. And so it was just a good pairing for the two of us.
You guys went way back. Yeah, I read that in the early days of Stax, Booker T used to do his paper route and then come and play on sessions.
I mean, oh, yeah.
He was so young. Amazing.
Yeah.
One thing I noticed is that a lot of the early Stax stuff, there's no producer credited at all.
Well, that's true, because, you know, this was the beginning of creating an industry that we knew nothing about as far as from a legal standpoint. So we didn't know about that you could make money off of production or something like that. All we knew is that we were good musicians or good singers or something, and we enjoyed making music. So it took a couple of years for us to catch on to that. Oh, you can make money in publishing, and you can make money in, yes.
Yeah, Jim Stewart really made some colossally bad business decisions while making some amazing music. You know,
absolutely. I mean, we were all more or less flying by the seat of our pants. Jim was a banker and a country fiddle player.
Hmm.
And so he just kind of backed into this sax thing. You know, he loved music, but he didn't have any idea of all the behind the scenes things that from a business standpoint. So we all were playing catch up there. Mm.
Yeah, 1967, Every Day Will Be Like a Holiday, another song that's been covered a lot. 1968, Otis Redding passes away, and you wrote that song, Tribute to a King. I believe you sing on Otis's version of Respect, maybe a couple other Otis sessions, is that right?
Right, I did the harmony with him on Respect, because I, luckily, I guess as fate would have it, I was in the studio on a furlough and doing some recording when Johnny Jenkins and Otis came in.
Huh.
And they needed, they didn't have enough material for Johnny, so they asked if anybody had a song, and so Otis, of course, had These Arms of Mine.
Right.
And Otis and I just kind of hit it off from day one and became very good friends, and of course I went back off to the military, and then when I came back he was a big superstar. So. But we did travel and tour quite a bit after I got back.
People often talk about just the electricity he brought to a session and the magnetism and just the way he could inspire the whole band and get the horn arrangements going in his head. I mean, what was that like?
Oh, he would never write down a complete song. He always had the first line of every verse, and he never sang anything the same way. It was all almost like he knew what the first line of the verse was, and everything else was just spontaneous creations, you know, and that's what made it so great, because he was living what he was singing during that time, and you could just feel it.
Hmm. Well, is there a secret to the Stax sound, to the success of all those records? I mean, musically, is there something that happened?
I don't know. I think the secret, if there is a secret, it was just the pairing of different musical elements. I mean, Steve and Duck coming from the rockabilly, kind of sound, and then you have Al and Booker coming from that church blues jazz thing, and then I think the combination of that sound and everything, it just created a whole different sound, and the building that, which was an old theater building, that we were recording in, it was almost like doing it live.
Yeah.
With the acoustics and everything.
Yeah, 1968 with Judy Clay, you recorded Private Number, and that was a hit, and again, another song that's been covered a lot of times, and we heard it, there's a bunch of Jamaican reggae, mostly ska versions of that song. That we heard one of earlier. You also had time to write songs for Carla Thomas and Ollie and the Nightingales, the Astors, Albert King. You wrote some with Steve Cropper. It seems like you're a busy guy back then. Obviously the hanging out thing was important. Was there a policy that folks could just walk in the door of Stax and be heard?
Well, at the beginning, that was that policy for a couple of years. Of course, it had to tighten. But, you know, we were hanging out, but we were working at the same time and learning. So when we would hang out, of course, there was always, if you had the ability to play or write, and they were saying that, well, Sam and Dave is coming in, or Otis is coming in for a session, or Rufus Thomas, and do you have anything that you can present? And so, of course, a lot of writing was done, and they would pair off different people to get different sounds and different feels. So it was just a creative, that creative energy was high during that time.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, and I recommend people get books or, you know, information about Stax, because it really is an amazing story. It sort of started to go downhill in the late 60s. it's hard to know exactly. It seems like the definitive reason why it all happened has never quite been told. There was some funny business with money and banking and loans. And it seems also like the racial tensions that were happening in Memphis at that time sort of got the pressure cooking a little bit.
I think it was a combination of a lot of things. Of course, we went from being a small mom and pop company to big corporate conglomerate. That was one of the things that was wrong, which a lot of people that came on board didn't really, they were there for the monies and not had the best interests of the artist or the behind the scenes people. So that was one of the things, bad business deals. And of course, after the death of Otis and Dr. King, it just changed the atmosphere quite a bit. And we had some success after that. As a matter of fact, when Stax filed bankruptcy, we had records on the charts. But we had some business dealings, and there were some, I guess you would say, political reasons. So there were a whole group of things that were happening during that time that contributed.
Yeah. Did you manage to hold on to your publishing, and are you sort of taken care of pretty well from, you know, now here we are so many years later? Do you still do all right from just writing these great songs?
Oh, yeah. Of course, the first, like I said, the first 5 years of my contract with Stax, Jim and East Memphis had the publishing on all of that. But then, of course, after a couple of years, you realize that, you can make money with publishing, too, and you can make money. And so I made money more or less from not only my writing, but I got, when I re-signed, I got part of my publishing and got some production things going. So
when you talk about giving, you know, your first 5 years, you sort of signed away your publishing. Do you still have the writer share of that?
I still have the writers. Jim was a good man. That's why I said he did not take the writers or anything like that. But the publishing end of it was handled through East Memphis. And during that time, we were only more or less interested in getting our music out there, being a good artist, and writing songs. So we didn't look at the behind-the-scenes aspect until a few years later. So, Jim always gave us the writers, credits, and everything. And so we, when somebody would do a song or something, from the early days of, like, with Born Under a Bad Sign and all that stuff, I didn't have the publishing, but the writers are still intact.
Yeah, that's great. You had some hits in the 70s. You've been sampled many, many times. Your records, lots of your records, have been sampled by all different folks. Is that something you get a little piece of?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, since the last couple of years of Stax, I had part of publishing and my writers, of course, is intact. And from all the samples and everything, and then when I started my own label and everything, of course, the masters are mine. So, yes, we had put all those mechanisms in place.
Who knew that sampling would become, you know, who would have ever dreamed of that? Folks can check out williambell.com or also ponderosastomp.com/Lincoln and hear about your big gig, which is coming up Thursday the 16th, 6:30 p.m. in New York City. It's you, Harvey Scales, and the Bob Betts, of course, and our own alumni, Meredith Oakes, will be DJing there, and the whole thing will be broadcast live right here on WFMU during Dave the Spaz's program. I've seen you live before, and it's a lot of fun. There's slow songs, there's up songs. It's great. You're clearly one of these guys very comfortable on stage with a lot of experience. Is it something you still look forward to?
Oh, yes. I am looking forward to this. The Big Apple has always been very good to me. The people are wonderful, so I'm looking forward to it, and I am very comfortable. I'm more comfortable on stage than I am backstage, I think. And that's kind of funny because I'm more or less grew up performing on stage with, you know, like I said, from the Memphis days.
That's very interesting. This is going to be a fantastic show. Folks can get tickets at PonderosaStomp.com/Lincoln, and they can check out WilliamBell.com for information about what you're up to just generally. Now, I've got the song Private Number queued up here. What else do we need to know about this fantastic song? It's such a great song. The strings and everything. Is it one of those things when you heard it coming out of the speakers when the final mix was done, did you feel satisfied? Did you say, hey, this is really a piece of work here?
Well, you know, we originally did that for Judy Clay, and we never got together in the studio together to record it, because I wrote it for her because Jim had asked again. It was one of those situations. She finished her recording session, and I'm in the studio. Jim said, do you have anything that Jackie can record? And I had this half song, so Booker and I went over to his house in the Den and sat up all night, wrote it, came back the next day, but Jackie had for another previous engagement, actually in New York, so she had to leave, so I had to put the song down for her, and we sent the tapes to New York, and of course the powers that be up there got the idea that this would make a great duet, and they let me do the first verse and sing the chorus, and then put Jackie's singing the chorus with me and recorded her during the second verse. So we never actually in the studio did it, which was kind of strange.
That's amazing, because it does sound really natural.
Yeah, I know. And we did perform it live on stage, though, a few times, yes.
All right. Well, let's hear this fantastic song. We will see you Thursday the 16th up at Lincoln Center for the Get Down with Harvey Scales, the Bobettes, and, of course, the great William Bell. Thanks so much for visiting with us and giving us a little insight this morning.
Oh, thanks for the invite, and I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks so much.
All righty.
Nothing's wrong.